ask you to turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 25, and I want you to go down to verse 21 beginning. Well, we have a new addition here. Welcome Sydney over here. All right, Genesis chapter 25, beginning with verse 21, is talking about the births of Esau and Jacob. And I think there's some very interesting, very important things here in the overall narrative of Genesis we need to focus our attention on. Read along with me. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, "If it is so, why then am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. Just several things in that paragraph, I think, that are very important for us to note. First of all, are you struck by the fact, as you go through the book of Genesis, how often the matriarchs have problems conceiving? What's the significance of that in the book of Genesis? Okay, but why do you think that these particular women, for whom it was so important that the bloodline continue, what do you think is the significance of the fact that they keep having difficulty conceiving? Sarah was barren, you know, all of those years, and now Rebecca, the wife for Isaac, we just had great emphasis in the story about Isaac finding a wife, and she's the perfect wife, and now she is having trouble conceiving. Yvonne? I think that's exactly right. I think if we miss that as we go through Genesis, then we're missing something very important. The promise of God concerning Abraham and his seed and all of that, it was absolutely dependent upon the female role and the female role as a child bearer. And I think you have to put all that in the context, as we mentioned last class, I believe, in the context of what God had pronounced in his curse upon the serpent back in Genesis chapter 3, where God had said that the seed of woman would be at enmity with the serpent, and the seed of woman would crush the head of the serpent, and he, the serpent, would bruise the heel of the seed of woman. And I realize, and I've given some lessons on this in the past, I realize that we tend to immediately jump ahead to Jesus. And obviously that's the ultimate fulfillment of that promise. But you need to see how God is unfolding all of this throughout the pages of history, and in particular throughout the pages of the book of Genesis, because this promised seed starts with the seed of Abraham, the promised seed of Abraham, the offspring of Abraham. And yes, the Messiah would ultimately come from that seed of Abraham that God promised him, but it all starts here with these who are the women associated with Abraham and his lineage, and their ability to then conceive and bring forth the promised offspring. And so to emphasize that, and I think Yvonne's exactly right, to emphasize God's hand in all of this. What you see is just in a natural way, these women are having trouble conceiving. And so circumstances would seem to be trying to thwart God's plan. So, you know, that kind of goes back to this whole idea of what God said to the serpent. And there's going to be this conflict. And God's people in conflict with the serpent who's trying to undermine Yahweh. And yet what we see is that regardless of the difficulties, Yahweh always fulfills His promise. Even when it looks like there might be something threatening the fulfillment of that promise. So here you've got Isaac. He finally marries, and his wife can't get pregnant. Might seem like that the promise of God is stymied. And so Isaac prays to God about that. Well, she does then conceive. But then what's the problem that she notices? The text describes it as the children are struggling together in her womb. All right, now you mothers help us ignorant males out about some of this. Okay. Does she understand at this point that she has twins? No. And every woman who's pregnant, I understand, can feel the baby and, of course, you know, all that. And sometimes we talk about how the baby's always just jumping around. It's just so active. But there's something unusual that she is experiencing there. And what do you think is going through her mind when she's feeling all of these strange things in her womb? What is she worried about? She doesn't know that there's a they in there. She doesn't know anybody's fighting. What, from her perspective, what do you think she's worried about? Okay, I mean, something's wrong. She doesn't understand this. Something's wrong with my pregnancy. And yet, she knows that she's supposed to be the one who's to bring forth more of the promised seed of God. And so, that's her question. If God answered my prayer so I could conceive and now ultimately, hopefully, give birth, well, then if it's a problem in pregnancy, well, then why did God do all this? You know, why am I this way then? That's her question to God. And so Isaac prays, and the Lord reveals then this. And here's this poetic, from her perspective, I'm sure it was a lot more vague, prophecy that God gives. Now, we're on this side of it, so we can appreciate it better. But look at what the Lord said to her. Two nations are in your womb. She probably thought, well, that's about the way it felt. Yeah. Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Now, I don't know if she was able to figure all that out ahead of time as to what that meant, that there were twins in her womb, and they were struggling in all of this. But at least what you see is that when she finally does go into labor, it becomes evident when the first child comes out that there's another child in there too. In fact, what's even more remarkable about those two children in the delivery? Yeah, when this first child, Esau, comes out, and I'm assuming coming out head first as you're supposed to. Well, then when his foot comes out, there's a hand grabbing onto the foot, you know. And so there's another child that's in there and grabbing on to his twin brother's heel. And so, you know, then it begins to be a little clearer as to what God meant by all of this, that these are going to be two boys who will grow into men who will be the fathers of respective nations, respective peoples, and the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Now, there's just a whole lot of things that are interesting about all of this. First of all, the idea that the younger son would be dominant over the older son, the older would serve the younger. Was that the cultural norm? No. No. In fact, you get into this whole issue that we'll see in the next few verses about the birthright. And the birthright in the ancient culture, it's very evident that this is the case when you look at the biblical text. The birthright went to the eldest son. And what did the birthright for the eldest son mean? What privilege did that put him in? First point is he's the leader of the clan. Leadership role goes to that eldest son who has the birthright. And really, when you go on and look at that further, there is a second thing that generally went along with that, and that's like an extra portion of the inheritance. Because you are the leader, in fact, even at times a double portion of the inheritance. And when you think about this from the perspective of the law of Moses, and remember, Genesis is just the first book of the law of Moses that was given to Israel. In the law of Moses system, that very clearly was spelled out, that the one with the birthright, the eldest son, would get a double portion of the inheritance. Double over all the other children that might come. So God's prophecy was that the older shall serve the younger. So that's absolutely not the way it normally would be. But the nation coming from the younger child would actually have dominion, be stronger and have dominion over the nation coming from the older child. And they would be struggling. And so really what then you see is that these two twin boys who are, you know, vying for position in their mother's womb, even though they're just fetuses, yet all that is symbolic of what really would be the case in their lives. In their lives as individuals, they would be struggling against one another, vying for control, vying for power. And not just on that individual level, but then the nations that would descend from them, they would be in the same circumstance. Now, without getting ahead too far, we all know the nation that comes from Jacob. Who are the descendants of Esau? All right, the Edomites, who I think probably are mainly in view here. The Edomites are the descendants of Esau. Any others that you can think of? The Amalekites were a marauding nomadic tribal group that were the descendants of Esau. And ultimately, we're kind of jumping ahead here, but ultimately, does anybody recall what happened to the Amalekites? Somebody remumble that. I heard somebody mumble something. They were destroyed by? All right. Saul destroyed most of them. And ultimately, the Israelites then conquered the Amalekites, all per God's curse that you actually see when you go on to Exodus chapter 17. So again, that all kind of fits in with this whole idea that the younger son would have dominion over the older son and the peoples coming from him. Though I do think probably the emphasis here is on two nations, and I do think the emphasis is Israel and then Edom, and they're vying for control. But ultimately, the Edomites are subjugated to Israel. Who's the one in Israel who subjugated the Edomites? You recall in your Old Testament history? Who's the great king for Israel? David. Yeah, David subjugated the Edomites, and they became part of this empire of Israel that David and Solomon then ruled over. Okay. So now we'll kind of keep that in mind because we're going to come back to all of that later. Now, one other thing, the names of these boys, according to the text. It's interesting. Why do they name that eldest twin Esau? Ralph? Esau, I mean, these are obviously fraternal twins here. Esau is very hairy, reddish hair, like a hairy garment. I take it Sydney is not like that at all, Mom. I'm confident of that. Just reddish hair all over him. The second twin is very, very smooth. And the word Esav in Hebrew means reddish. Usually was used to refer like maybe to a cow or a reddish heifer with that reddish kind of hairy coat. But that's then the name that then they give because, you know, they're always looking for something that would relate to that person and in some way be a characteristic of that person. So that's the name that he receives. Esau is referring to that reddish kind of hairy coat. And now the name Jacob, that's really important. In the ancient culture, one of the expressions that you would use if you were talking about somebody taking the place of somebody in a higher position, somebody supplanting another person, the idiom that they would use would be to grab that person by the heel. If you're if you're playing football and you're trying to catch the guy who's going toward the end zone, you might dive for his feet to trip him up. If you're chasing after somebody, you might try to grab onto that person's feet to trip him up so you can get ahead of him. If you were trying to beat somebody in a race, you know, that kind of thing. So the expression to grab somebody's heel was an idiom that they would use to refer to taking the place of somebody. So when somebody in a lower position took over the position that the other person had, then he is taking him by the heel. Okay, well, they give Jacob the name Yaakov. Yaakov, Jacob, we would say. Yaakov in Hebrew, it sounds like that expression to grab someone by the heel. And so that's the name that they give. A lot of times these biblical names, it isn't that the name itself means such and such, though with Esau that was the name for Red. Sometimes it's a phonetic thing. It sounds like the word for whatever it is. And so that's the case here. Yaakov sounds like to grab somebody by the heel to take over their position. And what was so ironic is that's exactly what was the case when Esau came out. His younger brother was grabbing him by the heel. I mean, you put that in connection with the prophecy that God had just made. Well, then you can't treat that as just some interesting coincidence. I mean, there's some providence in all that because that's symbolizing what the prophecy said would be the case with those two boys. That younger one would supplant the older one and would take his dominant position. Agnes? No, that's another cultural action, but that's a totally different cultural thing. No, totally different. Okay, so that's why they named these two boys what they do. All right, any question or comment about that? All right, well then keep going down to verse 27. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. A lot of sermons been preached upon that parenting tactic. Probably not a real good parenting tactic. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Esau said, "Behold, I'm about to die. So of what use then is this birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. All right, what we see here in Genesis, it's really a point that the Apostle Paul makes when he just comments on this text in Romans chapter 9. Where God made a choice that he was going to fulfill his promise through the younger son, Jacob, rather than the older son. And Paul makes the point in Romans 9 that that choice didn't have anything to do with anything that those two men did, or was it just completely God's choice and God's action? Well, when did God make the choice? When they were still in the womb, before they'd even done anything good or bad. And that's the point Paul makes. And it's just, he's just reading the book of Genesis like we are. I mean, he's obviously inspired, but I'm just saying that he's just observing there what we certainly see. God made a choice. Now, does the text explain to us at all why God chose Jacob over Esau? Nope. And, you know, people always ask that question, and we don't know. It obviously doesn't have anything to do with the fact that, well, Jacob was an outstanding godly man, and Esau was just a reprobate. Because, frankly, when you go on in the text, Jacob's a pretty shady character here. And even what you see right here with him getting his brother's birthright, and then later we will see he steals his brother's blessing. Jacob is not a very savory fella here, but the real point in all this is God made his choice. And as we keep going in the book of Genesis, what even Jacob is going to finally come to realize is that God made his choice and is fulfilling this promise through me and is blessing me, even though there's absolutely nothing that I have done to possibly deserve this. That's the point the Apostle Paul makes in the book of Romans. And he uses that as an analogy for then our salvation, that, you know, we have been chosen in Jesus Christ, but it's not because we're so great. There's nothing we have done to deserve that. It's simply God's choice. And so that's what we're seeing here with Jacob. So I'm emphasizing that because very often people say, well, Jacob is such a bad guy here. He's as bad as Esau. You know, why does God choose him? Well, the whole point is God's choice was not based upon Jacob was just such a great fella. Now, I do think ultimately when you go through Jacob's life, you see Jacob and Esau both maturing spiritually and ultimately changing their ways. But right here in this section of the text emphasizes Esau and his fault. It's not overlooking Jacob, but what it does emphasize is there's something absolutely reprehensible about the character of Esau. What is it? He despised his birthright, meaning he didn't care one whit about the honored position that he was in. And he was willing to sell it for a pot of red stew. Did he have a rationale for why he was willing to make that sale? What was his rationale? I'm so hungry, I'm going to die. What do you think about that rationale? Is that pretty accurate reasoning, you think? Pretty rash, yeah. Do you think he really was just going to die? I mean, if he hadn't gotten that, he eats that stew and then back to hunting again. Okay, doing fine, you know. I don't think that one meal was really that crucial. And yet, that's just kind of the way he viewed it. And so what it shows is he did not have any regard for his birthright. I think it's interesting. I won't take time to turn over there, but that's exactly the point the Hebrew writer points to in Hebrews chapter 12, where he warns us as Christians not to despise our birthright that we have in Jesus Christ and sell it for anything that we rationalize that this earthly life has to offer us. Because whatever we think is so important in this earthly life, we're just like Esau. It's really the equivalent of just selling that birthright for a bunch of red stew. And we delude ourselves into thinking that whatever it is in this earth that's so more important than our birthright in Jesus Christ, we are deluding ourselves. There's no comparison. We're really showing we despise that birthright in Jesus Christ. Well, this is the incident the Hebrew writer is pointing to. And I think we need to really appreciate that. And then the text says his name is then, or he's given an additional name, Edom, and there's significance there. The word Edom in Hebrew is the word for the color red. And so he was willing to sell his birthright and all the honor and privilege that that afforded him for just a little pot of red stew. And so when he came home, hang on a second, when he came home and all this is made clear, obviously, to Isaac and Rebecca, and he swore that he was giving up his birthright for this red stew, that becomes the name that is attached to him. That stew was more important to him than the birthright. And that, of course, would be the name given then to his descendants, the nation of Edom. Okay, Bill? Oh, yeah. What's it indicate about like Jacob? Is he a quality person here? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So, you know, that's what I was saying earlier, is that neither one of these boys are exactly stellar when it comes to, serving God. And as we go on further, we're going to see Jacob even has some greater character flaws. Major character flaws, at least here in this early part of his life. Yeah. You know, it's always interesting whenever someone wants to get out on the precipice of a cliff, they always want to grab the Bible class teacher to have them go along with them. I'm not exactly sure, Dave, I want to take that leap with you. But, maybe what you're getting at is that this parenting business of one parent favors the other one, and it's obvious that they do. And is that the best way to raise your kids to be children of character? Could maybe that have had an impact on all of this? I think so. That's not what the text puts the emphasis on, but I think that's certainly a good point. And that's all I really want to say about that, Dave, just for because of my fear of heights. That's all I want to say. Yeah, Irma? Oh, good. Well, you're in a much better position to agree. And certainly as we go on further, when we get to the incident of the blessing, that whole problem is going to manifest itself even more clearly. Tommy? By the time that the Israelite nation has contact with the Edomites and throughout Old Testament history, I don't believe so. Now, you know, at this time, of course, because he's part of that Abrahamic group, he would have practiced circumcision. But, you know, at some point, when the two nations then are separated from each other, I don't believe the Edomites then, that they continued that. Okay. Other comments, questions? Yeah, Jerry? Sure. All right, what's the point when it talks about Jacob being a man of the tents and a herdsman? He's a keeper of the flocks. He's not out there hunting, but he's, you know, I think sometimes people kind of get the idea that Jacob is sort of a wimpy guy or something. That's not what the text is saying, but it is certainly true that Esau and his hunting, and Isaac has a taste for the game and all of that, you know, and you can see why that would be maybe the kind of son that he might favor, you know. But I've had some people kind of act like they think Jacob is somehow kind of a, you know, wimpy man or something, and that's not at all the implication. Yeah, Isaac.
Well, it's just another question. Cain and Abel was favoritism, what general family wanted to possibly be there, and now here, inheritance. One gets and one doesn't get. Enter the problem, jealousy, all kinds of conniving. It just makes me realize with eternal life, everyone gets the same prize. There's no, you know, God hasn't given us an opportunity to be jealous of one another.
Yeah.
When we consider eternal life.
Well, and, you know, you could even maybe imagine, well, you know, maybe some of these who were not chosen children in the chosen lineage might have been jealous of some of that. But ultimately, what God's promise was that all families would be blessed in the promised seed. And as you're pointing out, what God had in mind for all that was that even those who are Gentiles, like us right here, we reap equal benefit with those of the physical seed of Abraham. And so, you know, God, you know, if you just do it God's way and trust in God, all the fairness and equity, God's going to make sure everything's fair and equitable. And so often we as human beings just don't think it is, and so we then decide to go our own way and not do it God's way. Okay. Yeah. Good point. And even the word that the text uses, he despised his birthright. Maybe that's not the way Esau would have characterized it, but that really was the way to characterize it. He really despised it. I mean, he showed that. Okay, very good. Chapter 26, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on chapter 26, but it's a very important chapter. It's none of these sections of Genesis are just in there for no reason. Keep in mind, it isn't that everything that happens to these patriarchs is recorded. Only those events that are regarded by God as key events. So what you see here in chapter 26, there is a reason for it. It's a key chapter, a key moment here. Chapter 26, verse 1. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your seed I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and will give your seed all these lands, and by your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac lived in Gerar. All right. What is God emphasizing to Isaac by all those words? Right? But that promise that he had made to Abraham, God is passing that down to Isaac now. Everything he promised Abraham, all the blessings, everything, I'm going to bestow all that upon you. He tells him not to go down to Egypt, but to stay here in the land, despite the fact that there's a famine. Why do you think Isaac might have wanted to go down to Egypt?
Because
Yeah, why Egypt, though? Egypt, remember how we talked about this? At this point in history, Egypt is the dominant nation of that whole southwestern part of the Fertile Crescent. So, you know, that's the nation that one would be tempted to go to when there were times of famine in Canaan, and God says, don't do that. You stay here in the land. So, you know, that's having to rely then upon God, and that's what God's emphasizing. I'm going to bless you. So don't go to Egypt. Stay right here in the land and sojourn here. And so Isaac sojourns in Gerar. And where have we come across that before? Isn't that the same Philistine city that Abraham had sojourned at? Okay. And what then, and I'm not going to take time to read the rest of the chapter, but what then does Isaac do while he's at Gerar, and is he and his wife Rebekah come in contact with Abimelech, the king of that city-state? He lies about her being his wife. He says, well, she's my sister, and doesn't reveal that she is his wife. Does that ring a bell? That's exactly what Abraham had done. Abraham did it twice. Abraham, one of those two times, was right here in Gerar when he lied to Abimelech. Now the term Abimelech is the royal title, like Pharaoh. So I don't know if this is the same Abimelech, the same king as Abraham had encountered. But the point is, it's like a mirror image of all that's going on. Right after the time when God, in a mirror image, had taken the promise to Abraham and bestowed it upon Isaac. And what do we see Isaac doing? Not completely trusting God's protection, and he wants to, like Irma said a moment ago, he wants to kind of help God out, and you know, so he thinks, well, lying about this is going to be the way to succeed. And again, what you see in all of this is that God does bless him and keeps Rebekah from being violated in any way. And God keeps his promise. And as a result of all of this, when Isaac leaves there, the relationship between him and the Philistines here of Gerar, it is a improved relationship, and he ultimately is blessed even materially from all of this. It's exactly what God had done previously with Abraham. Okay. All right. So all of this is important because God's promise is still the issue. And again, what we see is that God's people are not always 100% committed to God's promise. They show weaknesses, but God is always true to his word. Okay, is that the second bell? We just had one. Okay, these kids get out early. All right, I am. We needed to get through chapter 27, but I don't guess we can. I'm going to start with chapter 27 on Wednesday night, and we're going to go all the way from chapter 27 to. About chapter 31. So I'd like everybody for Wednesday night to be prepared for us to discuss chapter 27 through 31. If we don't stay on our schedule, then we're going to be behind and not be finished with Genesis by the end of the quarter. Okay, any final comments as we're waiting for that second bell? Yeah, Jerry? Excellent point. Okay, any other comments? All right, we'll go ahead and stop there. Thank you, folks.